Starting. All attendees are in listen-only mode.
Welcome to today's Janie B. Journal Club webinar, the first webinar in our start of our eighth semester. So glad to have you with us. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Associate Executive Director of SDB, and I'll start us off with a little bit of housekeeping. We will take questions at the end of the presentation, or actually Christopher said if there's a question that makes sense as he goes through, don't hesitate to go ahead and type that. So if you have questions, type that in the chat block, the question bar. Christopher has made the handouts for today's presentation available. So if you look in the GoToWebinar toolbar, you should see a handout that you can go ahead and download, follow along and make notes during the presentation. When I close out the webinar today, you'll see a short survey and would appreciate your feedback on this session, as well as particularly ideas for the future webinars. We're going to be planning the spring semester here shortly and would definitely love to hear ideas on topics that can be covered. And watch for an email from me on Wednesday of this week that'll include a link to the recording that we're making, the slide handout again, as well as the CEU certificate that you're earning through your attendance today. And happy to have Ginger Quick back as our moderator for the series. She's at Rutgers University in the Department of Nutritional Sciences.
Okay, great. Thank you, Rachel, for those nice introductions. And we're really excited this semester. We have a nice lineup of various speakers talking on a number of different topics. And we're very excited to have today Dr. Christopher Wharton. He's an associate professor of nutrition at Arizona State University School of Nutrition and Health Promotion. He also directs the Food Systems Transformation Initiative at ASU. And his primary research interests include dietary and lifestyle behavior change, leveraging both technology and concepts of voluntary simplicity. He also studied local food systems, food security, and food system sustainability, and in particular from the perspective of small-scale community farm operations. Carol Johnston, which is one of his colleagues, is Associate Director of Programs at ASU. Unfortunately, she fell ill today and will not be able to join us, but she would be happy to answer any questions, follow-ups from the presentation today, along with Christopher. So it's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Christopher Wharton and presenting today his topic on smartphone apps for dietary self-monitoring.
Well, thank you both very much for inviting me on, and I apologize that Carol couldn't be here. She just let me know this morning. She and I collaborated on this project, smartphone apps focused on self-monitoring of dietary intake, and unfortunately, she has some of the knowledge about how this has progressed. She's been doing follow-up studies, so I may or may not be able to answer some of those questions, but certainly she and I both will be available for follow-up questions via email or otherwise. I always love the introduction that I get because as you progress through the ranks of professorhood, you just are asked slash required to wear more and more hats. And so whereas I used to have this very narrow range of research interest, as you read that out, I realize I now have like a dozen. But that's okay. That makes things interesting. One of them happens to be our interest in using technology for dietary self-monitoring. And so that's what we're going to be talking a little bit about today. I'm presenting on results of a pilot weight loss trial that we conducted a couple years ago and was published in the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior, I think, in 2014. And so what we'll talk a little bit about is the role of dietary self-monitoring in weight loss, and then what could be going on, what has been going on, what could be going on in terms of technological innovation to facilitate dietary self-monitoring in a way that traditionally it hasn't been facilitated. So then I'll go into just a little bit about the study. It was a very simple, straightforward 8-week weight loss trial and the results that we found, which I think are really interesting and informative, at least conceptually, for us to think about how we employ technological innovations in things like dietary self-monitoring and other health behaviors. And then we'll discuss some of those concepts and a little bit about continuing work. As I'm sure many of you in the audience are aware of, if not all of you, there are plenty of traditional tools available for dietary monitoring. All right, so we have, you know, one of the gold standards, of course, is a 24-hour recall. That's been used quite a long time, and that's obviously one of the key ways to gather dietary information and get granular with it, to understand not only what people are consuming, and you're asking people, in this case, participants, to recall their last 24 hours of what they ate and drank, but to get to the level of what specifically was consumed, what brand was it, how much, and what preparation, those levels of detail to really get at information like caloric intake, macro and micronutrient intake, and the like. Of course, there are food frequency questionnaires. Those are different in that they're less about that granularity and quite a bit more about actual dietary patterns. So whereas you may or may not be actually calculating specifics of caloric and other types of intake of individuals, here you're going to see what are patterns over time to understand, you know, whether people are consuming whole grains or fruits and vegetables with any kind of regularity. And then there are diet records, and this is, of course, just a sample, but some of the primary means of dietary monitoring. And diet records are really all about achieving that granularity, but having it over time as well. And so you're going to ask participants to actually record, hopefully at the point of consumption, what it is they're eating, what it is they're drinking, down to that level of detail that we try to achieve with 24-hour recalls as well. But then over the course of, say, 3 days or 7 days or other conventions that are out there. And you probably are also familiar with or could imagine the considerable limitations that come along with these types of monitoring tools. And really, this has been, I think, a significant problem for diet and health-related research for a number of years, and it's been getting called out more and more. Our ability to say anything that's accurate, anything with precision about people's diets using these types of tools, given their limitations, the barriers they present. So 24-hour recalls, for example, or any type of recall when it comes to diet information, you're relying on people's memories, something we really try hard not to do generally because people's memories are suspect, not that people can't remember things, but people aren't necessarily trained to be thinking about, again, that level of detail of what it is they're consuming, and so it's very easy to lose even small details, but details that could be quite critical. So, again, preparation of a particular item, take a slice of bread, for example. People might remember they ate some bread, but was it a piece of processed white bread or was it a, you know, piece of whole grain bread? Was it actually 100% whole grain or was it simply just made with whole grains? Was it a dainty piece of bread at 70 calories or a really thick piece of bread at 170 calories? Did you put butter on that? What type of spread was it? All of these things obviously add up and can make big differences in the outcomes that you're interested in. And then, of course, there is the consistency in reporting across a number of these tools. Even small omissions, a snack might have been a 350-calorie snack and laden with fat or sodium or other things. So small omissions in what people are consuming add up very quickly. And so the consistency in reporting is really vital. And that, you know, really leads into the last one there. And, again, this is just a sampling of limitations. There are others. But respondent burden, and this is the biggest one, well, as big as any other, really, where people have to take the time to either sit down, speak back to you what it is that they were consuming in a 24-hour recall, or fill out questionnaires, and especially with diet records, this is the most onerous, writing down the details of what was consumed and how much, meal after meal, snack after snack, perhaps day after day. That's quite a bit of burden, and that's actually kind of a difficult thing to facilitate and make easier. And this is one of those places where I become envious of physical activity researchers because, you know, there are certainly levels of sophistication, increasing levels of sophistication when it comes to physical activity documentation of people's physical activity. But oftentimes, if you want to get a baseline of basic activity, you can strap on a pedometer or an accelerometer and passively go ahead and gather those data. The participant doesn't really need to do anything other than wear a device. Are these, you know, we poor diet researchers have to think a lot about how to try to minimize that respondent burden because we have to ask people to think of all of this information and get it to us in some way. It's not at all passive. It's very active, and that takes a lot of time out of people's days, people who aren't used to perhaps thinking about diet in this way. But we do know from plenty of research, including the National Weight Control Registry, in which people self register and note a certain amount of weight that they've lost and have maintained that weight loss over time, we know that dietary self-monitoring is among the very, very few somewhat consistent strategies that people have used for successful weight management. dietary self-monitoring, consistent weighing, these sorts of things are usually helpful to people. But this is where all those burdens and barriers come in. And so there have been innovations, you know, over the past, again, decade that have been targeting trying to deal with the burdens and trying to facilitate dietary self-monitoring a bit. For example, web-based self-monitoring, the ASA 24 from the NCI, is an online self-monitoring system. It's a website dedicated to dietary record keeping, and there are others, of course. And that can help because you've got built-in databases. You can choose from lists of foods that you may have consumed and preparations and things and populate, you know, sort of a dietary record day by day. The difficulty, of course, is that websites, even though they're now virtual and perhaps mobile, there may be mobile versions of online databases where you can plug in your dietary information, they're still clunkier. They're still not as easy as a single function app that sits as an icon on your smartphone, perhaps, and you just tap that button and you're away doing the thing that you meant to do, rather than sitting down at a computer, logging on, getting to a website, signing in, and then beginning your entry. So this is a step in the right direction, but perhaps not as important as we need it to be. But there's been more and more research coming out of late on using mobile devices as monitoring tools within interventions. And the reason for that, of course, is clear. The increase in cell phone ownership is staggering, and smartphones in particular. So you can see on the small graph that I grab here from the Pew Internet, 65% ownership of cell phones in 2004 has grown to 92% today. So nearly everyone, close to everyone, owns a mobile phone. Of those, 68% own smartphones, and that is a near twofold increase in the past 5 years. So this is really key, of course, because any types of interventions where we're trying to help people be healthier, we would hope that those interventions are accessible to everyone, that they don't exclude parts of the spectrum of the socioeconomic spectrum, right? We want everybody to be able to be involved if they can be. It's certainly not the case that that could happen right now because still only two-thirds of us have smartphones in which these sorts of apps could be used, but clearly the trend is staggeringly high. It's going to keep going up, and at some point in the very near future, this will just simply be the convention. Basically, everyone will own not only a mobile phone but a smartphone. What we found interesting, though, at least at the time of the study, publication, is that few other studies had really considered the feasibility of specific commercially available apps for dietary self-monitoring. So, you know, many labs around the country have been focused on mobile health interventions and even perhaps in-house building their own apps using theory to try to drive the types of tools that exist within an app to make them most effective to achieve whatever health outcome it is. And at the time, actually, it's not even dozens of diet-focused apps, but there are, I'm sure, hundreds if not thousands of diet-focused apps that are now available commercially. And what's really key about this is that when apps are built in-house to test out within an intervention with the hope that the tools within them, because they are theoretically based, should be more effective to achieve the outcome, in this case, say, weight loss or weight management, the problem is these things really haven't yet been tested or may not necessarily have been tested with groups of consumers just in terms of their usability. You know, when it comes to technology, the user interface, how people interact with the technology, is as important as what the technology does itself. And so I worry that some of the studies that have come out that are focused on apps built in-house, you know, if they, say, fail to show much of an effect, you couldn't know necessarily if the effect or lack of an effect is due to the app and its theory-based tools not actually working very well, or if the app itself just wasn't designed graphically and otherwise very well, and it was actually clunky to use or difficult to use. These things can get in the way, I think, of how well an app works. And, of course, the vast majority of people are not going to be using apps that somebody's lab, unless there happens to be a really successful one that makes it on the iTunes or Android store. Instead, what most people are using are these commercially available apps that have come from companies. For example, Lose It, which is the one that we used in this study, or MyFitnessPal is an extremely popular diet tracking app as well. So we were really interested to take a look at these things that are actually out there that, you know, millions of people are using. Lose It, for example, on its website boasts that 50 million pounds have been lost across its users over time. when we published this study, and this was just a couple years ago, it was 30 million pounds. So that they contend at least that, you know, their rate of weight loss is quite rapid amongst all their individuals. But we really wanted to look at a commercially available app, one that we knew had a good food database, to see if it was feasible in terms of dietary self-monitoring, given how important dietary self-monitoring is for weight management. These are somewhat older screen captures of the actual app itself. It looks a little bit different today. But the main interface for Lose It, which is what we use in this study, includes this sort of calorie budget. And so you can see, based on your goal, and in this case we're setting people up to lose about 1 pound a week, you have a calorie allotment. And you can see how much you consumed in terms of calories throughout the day by logging foods. You can search particular foods, and you see you get this list. And then you can grab the specific food that you consumed and identify the amount, and then that will add the calories to your overall budget. And then as you exercise, those calories will be taken away. And so you can see that you have this budget that you can maintain and look at over time throughout the day. So it provides this immediate feedback about where you are, how many calories you have left to maintain an amount sufficient to lose a certain amount of weight or maintain a certain weight. So that brings us to the study. And really what the study was a feasibility study. Could we use this particular commercially available app within the context of an 8-week weight loss trial? So the broader focus of the trial, at least for the participants, was weight loss. We recruited individuals 18 to 65 years of age, stratified them by age and gender to try to balance that out across groups, and then randomized them into these three groups. And what we wanted to see was how feasible was it to use this particular app to self-monitor diet within the context of our weight loss trial. So we had 19 individuals in the end in the app group, and so those individuals were trained on how to use Lose It, the snapshots you just saw there. So they learned how to log their information. We also taught them how to, and we set up the app so that it would provide them a calorie budget sufficient to lose 1 pound of weight per week. So it was individualized in that way. So they learned not only how to use the app, but then also how to, on a daily basis, send us their dietary information. So the app itself can actually email out the day's log. And so that's how we got their dietary information. We had another group of memo users, and so these individuals went onto their smartphones, but they used the memo or note function to literally type in the foods that they were consuming. So very similar to a dietary log, but they were just typing it in using the smartphone interface. And then the paper and pencil users, we had 15 in that group in the end, and those individuals, we actually developed a paper and pencil log for them to carry around and jot down what it is they ate and drank throughout the day throughout the course of the study. Those individuals, the memo users, we had them email their memos or notes to us on a daily basis, and the paper and pencil users, we actually had them mail their or bring into the lab their logs on a consistent basis throughout the study. So as I mentioned, we trained everyone to try to lose a pound of weight a week. And so on the app, again, using the equation that the app uses, it calculated the calorie budget, and then people were able to adhere to that, and it was really as simple as that. For the memo and paper and pencil users, however, we actually trained them on the exchange system so that, and if you're familiar, this is, you know, foods are categorized into units that are exchangeable in terms of the calories and perhaps macronutrients so that you build a diet with exchanges across food categories sufficient to meet an allotted calorie amount so that in the case of weight loss, you would get up to a calorie amount sufficient to lose, in this case, 1 pound per week. And all groups we actually counseled to, they were not a very active group, so we counseled them to lose about 150 calories or have 150 calories worth of exercise per day throughout the course of the study. Now, the interesting thing about this was the Lose It group, the app group, they had that calorie gauge where they could see immediate feedback in terms of what they were consuming. But the memo and paper and pencil groups didn't have that sort of immediate feedback. So what we actually did in lieu of that to try to balance them out as much as possible was provide them weekly dietary counseling to help them sort of maintain and adjust to that exchange system that they were using to achieve the same rate of weight loss because they didn't have the daily sort of feedback of the calories. So in their case, they actually got feedback in terms of the records that we were receiving from them so that we could come back and say, okay, you're doing well here, but to maintain that 1 pound per week weight loss, let's focus on modifying this kind of thing. And then that way we try to keep them on track with the app users. So we collected data, pre to post data, in terms of body weight. That was obviously one of the primary outcomes, but we were also interested in dietary quality. If you're familiar with many of these weight loss apps, they usually are based primarily around the calorie gauge. That's what everybody's interested in if they're interested in losing weight. It doesn't necessarily give you much information in terms of diet quality, and we'll talk a little bit about that at the end. But we use a subset of their dietary records to calculate healthy eating index calculations, so an overall sort of broad index of the quality of their diet. And just for your information, within the context of this study, we assumed complete days of dietary logging would be at least 800 kilocalories of intake worth of food and beverage noted. This is based on, it was hard to find a convention for this, but we found one study that used something along these lines. Incomplete days we identified as logs that contained information of like 1 to 800 kilocalories of intake. And then missing days, we categorized any missing days, those that didn't have any data recorded at all. So in terms of baseline characteristics of our participants, by the study groups here, you can see that in terms of broad demographics, there really wasn't any difference across all of these broad characteristics. So everybody looked pretty much the same who we had randomized into the three groups. But here's where things get interesting. So we looked at complete days and incomplete days, missing days, because we were really interested to see the feasibility of using this app compared to these more traditional methods. The straightforward traditional method of a paper and pencil log versus a modified traditional method, still writing things down but doing it on your phone with a memo function, or actually using this commercially available app called Lose It. And what we found was the app users over the course of the study recorded far more complete days than the paper and pencil group did. So this was significantly different from the paper and pencil group, not actually different than the memo group. And the memo and paper pencil groups were not different from each other. So it definitely was superior, if you care to use that term, compared to the paper and pencil group in terms of complete days recorded. And when you think back to the idea that dietary self-monitoring could be a really important tool for weight management or weight loss, obviously the more consistent you are with that strategy, then the more likely it can be to help you achieve success. All groups lost significant weight, and you can see that in the bars on the left in this graph here, this table here. The average across groups was about 4.5 pounds. So from pre to post, within groups there was significant weight loss, but between groups there actually wasn't any difference. So you can see where the range was there. It was a pretty significant range. But yeah, no difference across groups, but this was just an 8-week weight loss trial, so not a long-term study. So we're curious to know over the course of a longer period of time if there might be a difference. When you look at the total HEI score, there was no significant difference. What possibly could have been a trend, but it's up for interpretation. You can see, though, the app group actually, again, no differences from baseline pre to post, but it did sort of trend downwards, while as the other groups were trending upwards. And if you recall, the app group, their only feedback really was the calorie gauge within the app itself. The memo and paper and pencil groups did receive diet-related feedback from a dietitian within the study on a weekly basis to help them keep on track with their weight loss. So they actually were getting a little bit of information about how to modify their diet, and within that there could have been, something related to quality that could have translated. But it's open for interpretation given these results weren't significant. And then when we actually broke out selected HEI categories just to look to see if there might be differences within these subgroups, and there were no differences there. But as I mentioned, there were these trends noted that were sort of interesting to us to be thinking about. So as I mentioned, it was really a simple feasibility study. But what was interesting is that, and I didn't note it here, while there were more complete days noted by the app users compared to the paper and pencil group, there are also fewer incomplete days. So we didn't do much with the I'm sorry, not incomplete, but missing days. We didn't do much with the incomplete days data, but the missing days, there are actually fewer missing days in the app group, again, compared to paper and pencil. So in terms of feasibility, in terms of consistency, that seems to be a really key thing, that it does look like using a mobile device could be useful, and it could be preferred compared to these other forms of dietary self-monitoring. And, of course, apps now offer a consumer-friendly sort of format to collect data in all sorts of ways. And it's not just apps you find on your smartphone, but apps you now find on your watch or other digital devices that we're carrying around with us in a variety of ways. And this is becoming really, I think, the norm in terms of how people interact with information about themselves. We are now able to catalog and collect all sorts of health and other types of information about ourselves using apps. And so as sort of becoming the standard, the norm by which we do collect data, it seems to make sense that we want to transition to digital technologies like this to collect these sorts of data, because this is how people are sort of beginning to operate on a day-in and day-out basis. And, of course, as I mentioned, mobile phones are becoming ubiquitous, and smartphones as well. And one of the key premises of this study was that, well, you know, you create a diet log, say, for the purposes of a study to gather dietary information. That's fine. But really, in real life, if we really care about people being able to do something in real life, mobile phones are probably the key place to go because of their multifunctionality. If you think about it, we probably are checking all of our social media on our phone, and we're checking our email and checking our calendars and actually maybe even making a phone call with a thing, checking our time, and, of course, using all these apps for different specific purposes. So that multifunctionality means, of course, that our phones are almost always in our pockets or our purses or somewhere close to our person. That makes it that much easier for us to collect and catalog information that could help us make a change if we are interested in doing so. Now, there are difficulties that I think are really key. One of the things that we noted in the study is, and again, while there were no differences, the trends were interesting, and we wonder about long-term what this might mean. But within apps like Lose It or MyFitnessPal, for example, there's a lot of information you can gather as you collect your own dietary intake about your calorie intake primarily. But then you can go in and you can look at micro and macronutrients. And what you see usually in these apps and others are a whole bunch of numbers, and maybe the extent to which you're meeting an RDA or a DRI, something like this. But the problem, of course, is that not a lot of people really know how to interpret those sorts of numbers. And so when it comes to quality of diet, these apps might not achieve what I think is really that very important goal. Because, of course, what we know from recent literature, I think, is that, you know, losing weight may be useful for health, but probably in and of itself isn't inherently important for health, unless you're perhaps significantly obese. But if you're slightly overweight and you employ a number of health behaviors, start, you know, eating better, being more physically active, even if you don't actually lose weight, that kind of doesn't matter. You can still improve your health. So what really matters, I think, in these apps, not only paying attention to what you're eating and the quantity in terms of calories, but knowing that you're actually improving the quality of your diet as you attempt to manage your weight is vital. And these apps don't necessarily have intuitive tools to help you do that. For example, you wouldn't necessarily know, even if you're meeting calorie limits to try to lose weight, that you're eating sufficient amounts of fruits and vegetables or whole grains or fiber or other important classes of food that we know are associated with health outcomes. So figuring out how to improve quality of diet is really key. And the other groups in our study who did get diet counseling, it looked like their diet quality might be going up over time, and that is really of interest to us. How do you combine a focus on weight loss with an equally important focus on diet quality? The other thing that I think is really key is sustaining behavior over time. So I think the inherent assumption built into these apps is that the accomplishment of managing or losing weight is just in and of itself self-sustaining. I mean, you can create goals, and there are now social functions built into these apps, and that's good. But, you know, how to sustain the behavior over time other than just looking at your own calories day after day, I think is a really key thing. And so obviously what's lost in these apps is something related to maintaining a behavior. Right? These are all outcomes-oriented, but the behavior to get there is non-existent. It's totally up to you. So more and more we need to be thinking about the types of tools that can that sort of buttress the behavior that may or may not lead to actually weight loss, but at least could lead to improved diet quality and overall health. So in terms of continued and future work, of course, you know, given that this was a short-term feasibility study, we would be interested to see how these commercially available apps, and perhaps in contention with each other, which ones are more successful, not only at helping people manage their weight, but then sustaining that over time, and what tools within these apps, if any, could help people do that. So how does an app plus, for example, counseling impact weight management success? This is something I'm not totally familiar with the details, but I know Dr. Johnston is actually focusing on this type of app development. She's actually using other apps that are out there and then adding to that counseling to see what difference that might make. And then, of course, can we actually get smarter with our smartphones? The app data that's being generated, especially these commercially available apps, this is getting into the realm of big data. Can we find trends in the way people use these apps that elucidate how they can be effective in different ways? The social aspects of Lucid, for example, I wonder if there are ways that people connect to communities who are interested, have the same common goals, that might buttress people's attempts to lose weight. But the only way to really see that is to really get into these large databases that these companies may actually have now. And that's something that some other researchers I know are beginning to dig into as well. So it'll be interesting to see if we can use the massive data sets that these apps produce to help us understand even further what weight loss or weight management success might actually look like. So we had a number of master students on this project, Barbara Cunningham, Daniel Sterner, and Kevin Cohen, along with Carol and myself, conducting the study. And we had some funding from our ASU Foundation here, which we really appreciated. And I think I will stop there, and I'll be happy to take any questions, not only about the results of the study, but its implications and other thoughts people have about mobile applications for health.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Christopher Warren, for a lovely presentation. I know as we have a number of people that have a number of questions for you, and so if you do have a question, make sure you type it in the question box. So as they're coming in, one question I had for you regarding the app. I was curious to know what type of food database does that app specifically use? I'm just wondering if there are some limitations with finding the exact food that a participant might have eaten within the app to get the most accurate results.
That's a good question. With Lucid at the time, I believe it was its own database that had been generated. What's interesting about these apps too, and this is a potential, it's a way to vastly expand a food database, but also a potential pitfall in that I know at least some apps, and I believe MyFitnessPal might do this as well, allow users to enter new foods, you know, and then catalog that food's nutrition and other numbers. And I think people that work with particular apps will attempt to verify new foods that come in. But so they may not be a fully standardized database. There may be, you know, new foods that end up being perhaps through user error actually inaccurate. So if you find it, you know, you find a particular food that you consume that's not a commonly consumed food, if it's not been verified, there could be inaccuracies there. At the same time, though, we have a ridiculously varied diet, especially in the U.S., and so the databases need to grow over time, and this is a crowdsourced way to do it, so that actually can be helpful from that perspective.
Okay, great. Thank you. We also had a question regarding whether or not you've collected any qualitative data from these participants. Were you able to get any feedback after the pilot to get kind of get an understanding as to what maybe challenges or barriers they came across with using either the app or the paper pencil, and just to get a better sense as to how they felt about participating in those different methods?
Yeah, we did gather some qualitative data. It wasn't considerable enough for us to look for publishing it, but we did ask about people's experience using the various methods, and the what we might have expected occurred in that the app felt simplest to use, easiest to use, and that was, of course, reflected in the complete days recorded and these sorts of things. People did gripe a bit more, especially with the paper and pencil, just because this was an 8.5 by 11 sized document or notebook to be carrying around, and people don't want to be carrying around extra things. So that was a little bit onerous, reflecting that respondent burden issue. But qualitatively, that same theme did come out.
Okay, great, thanks. I was also curious to know, it was great that you stratified by age and gender. I was wondering if you also collected any information about their socioeconomic status or their racial makeup. I'm not as familiar with the literature on using these types of smartphone apps or, you know, weight loss management and so forth, but I'm curious to know if there's any differences in specific audiences and being able to use some of these types of methods.
Yeah, we did collect basic demographics, and everybody had to be a mobile phone user who came into the study. So one of the quirks of the study, at the time that we ran it, Lose It was available only on iPhone. So part of that, we mentioned semi-randomization, that occurred because we could only have iPhone users within the app group, and so we had a mix of Android and other users in other groups. And so that was one quirk that reviewers actually called us out on, but they weren't concerned enough to not publish our study. But the thing is with, I think, smartphones, especially this is now a couple years ago, and as you saw, smartphone use has doubled just in 5 years. So it definitely, the ownership is likely to suggest a certain level of socioeconomic status, and even today it continues to suggest that, given a third of individuals don't own smartphones. So, yeah, that's a concern, I think, that we have to be conscious of, that there may be, there likely are limitations in terms of people who would be involved or enrolled in the study. Given that this was a feasibility study, that wasn't a primary focus. It was really what was, you know, will people use this in a way that's more effective than other tools? But it is something definitely to be conscientious of.
Okay, great. Yeah, thank you. And on that note, I was just thinking about some, you know, there may be some people that might be a little bit more tech-savvy, maybe. I'm thinking of the older, you know, generations, like, might not be as tech-savvy, but maybe that's changed, just seeing the number of people that are using smartphones.
That's a good point, too. And actually, I'm trying to remember which outcome it was. I believe, so there was a correlation with age, I think, when it came to complete days recorded. That may have been a factor, but even when we controlled for that that potential confounder, it didn't change the result. There was still a significant difference in complete days recorded. But that may have been the case, and I think that there may still be, you know, sort of that generation gap, but it's becoming so ubiquitous that I think will quickly, quickly go away.
Okay, great. So we have a question from one of our listeners. She says, great presentation. She really found the HEI results very interesting. She was wondering if you considered other ways to get at diet quality other than using the HEI, and if you could just kind of give us an explanation as to why maybe you opted to use this, the HEI, versus other tools.
Well, we used HEI primarily. I think that's actually kind of been a convention in Dr. Johnston's lab to look at diet quality over time. We had run a couple of studies using HEI as just sort of a standard assessment of that, and to get, you know, it gives you sort of a nice broad sense of overall quality. Even though we did actually look at those subcategories as well, you have this nice index that's sort of more easily understood. It's hard to say much about quality in this study, given that there weren't actually differences across groups. And so it's a little bit hard to make the argument that, oh, there may be some trends there because there is no significance. But I think I wanted to bring it up because I think it's important to think about, given the user interface and structure of these apps, in that there really isn't otherwise a measure of diet quality in many of these apps. What you get are calories and micronutrient intake, so you just get numbers. And I think for the average individual who's not, you know, being trained up as a registered dietitian or a researcher in health, these things might actually be meaningless. Pretty quickly, you'll probably learn the context of calorie intake, but, you know, meeting, you know, let's say you're pulling in 10 milligrams of iron a day, is that important for you as a man or a woman? It's hard to know, right? But there's no way to know really what the proportionality is of your diet in terms of food groups, and I think that's a really important omission. And so that's something. So that's why we wanted to include the quality piece.
Right. Great. Now, the diet quality for the HEI, did you use the 2005 version, the newer one, or was it the older?
Question. I'd have to look at our paper to know which version we used. I think it was a 2005 version, but it's probably noted.
Okay. Okay. Now, were you able also to parse out the different, because I know there's a 12 different like food groups you can look at within the HEI. Were you able to kind of parse that out and look at maybe, they were able to meet more of maybe their fruits or vegetables, but not so much when it comes to whole grains, or were you able to see any patterns, I guess?
Yeah, unfortunately, no. The only real potential trend, again, maybe, that we saw was total HEI. And then we looked at the ones that I noted there, the subgroups that I presented on our slide are the ones that we actually took a specific look at just to see.
Okay.
And there weren't, again, any differences there. It was really the total HEI that we found intriguing.
Yeah.
So of course, it's possible for people to lose weight. So if you're given a tool like Lose It where you have a calorie gauge and now your sole focus is to remain under that, say, 2,000 calories a day in order to lose weight, it could be just all about sort of deprivation, right? Like you just stop at 2,000 calories regardless of what it is you've consumed throughout the day and you try to get by that way. That, of course, is a really difficult thing too, because if you're really focused on restriction to meet a calorie limit in order to lose weight, that's probably not going to be a good strategy for maintenance over time.
Right.
Sorry, I'm kind of rambling on, but I really think that the calorie plus quality thing is a really key point that a lot of apps might not be including at the moment.
Yeah, and actually I agree with you, because a number of the commercial apps that I have seen, they really don't have much, they focus more on the calories, not necessarily the overall diet quality. And one of the concerns, and maybe some other researchers might and dietitians have the same concern, is a lot of the consumers that use these products don't realize, you would have to try to lose weight gradually in order to maintain it long term. And I don't know if any of these apps, but the one that you used, gave them information on the appropriate amount of weight loss per week. I know you gave training, but I'm not sure a lot of these products, focus on that aspect.
Yeah, I think that you're right. I think there isn't necessarily a focus on that. And what that leads to, and I think this is another concern for people to be aware of, in terms of education of consumers on how to use these apps, is the conflation of weight loss with a health outcome. So the idea that, okay, I wanted to lose, say, 5 or 10 pounds, and I've actually achieved that, so now I'm healthy. Of course, that's not the case. If you've not changed how you eat and your ability to sustain a healthier pattern of dietary intake over time, all you've done is taken a potentially unhealthy version of yourself, and now you're a lighter unhealthy version of yourself. And also, if you've done it in a way that's really focused on restriction and not modifying how you eat to try to have a more sustained pattern of intake, you put yourself at risk for eventually regaining that weight, getting concerned about that, trying to lose again, and the weight cycling, sort of yo-yo dieting concern that we know is problematic for health too. The design of these things, I understand how they've evolved over time, but for those of us who are going to be in the profession or doing research, we have to be thinking about how to make sure they're used appropriately.
Right. Now, I know that you did mention with the app that they were encouraged to exercise on a daily basis. Is that recorded as well within the app? Did you look at any of the physical activity behavior patterns as well?
Right. So we didn't specifically look at their physical activity. We counseled them to be active about 30 minutes a day, most days of the week, 5 to 7 days a week, sufficient to achieve, 150 calories worth of exercise a day. So we tried to, that was as much as we did in terms of standardizing across the groups. Now, the app, the Lose It app, assigns, calories per a variety of activities. And so we used that. That was there for the app users if they were going to track their exercise, though we didn't focus on that with them. For the memo and paper and pencil groups, within the training that they got and their notebooks that they got, we actually had a list of activities that we pulled from the app to say this is roughly what, say, bicycling for a period of time equals 150 calories or walking or running, so that the types of activities they might engage in and the amount of time would be similar between the app group and the other groups.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. And, you know, me thinking as a dietitian and a public health person, I always try to think of the overall health and well-being and changing not only necessarily eating behaviors and when it comes to dietary intake, but also physical activity, but a new, you know, thing that's kind of come in is sleep and stress. Have any apps kind of incorporated this whole, like, holistic approach in trying to adjust the overall health and well-being? I'm just curious.
No, that's a great question, actually, and I'm not familiar. There certainly could be a single app that includes that sort of multifunction where you can track all of these different things. But, of course, devices now have suites of apps that do that. So I'm thinking now of, like, Apple iWatch, for example, where you know, you've actually got the sort of the mobile health suite of tools where you can actually, you know, it'll passively track your physical activity, your heart rate, and these sorts of things, and possibly sleep too. And then you can have other apps where you track diet. So at least they're all kind of being coordinated among suites of tools. And so I think we're headed in that direction. And I think you're right to be thinking about that. And this is actually now not specifically with this technology, but it's something I'm very much starting to think about. Whereas, again, the partition of health behaviors can actually be really problematic in terms of maintenance over time. This is a theory an idea that I'm working with that there's been a little bit of research on recently, that we often approach health behaviors, in this case, diet for weight management or weight loss, singly. And so we say, okay, it's time for me to get healthier. I've decided to do that. I'm going to lose some weight. Let me pull an app and let me focus on my diet. But, of course, that's a ridiculously incomplete picture, but that's unfortunately the picture that is presented to most people, especially in the U.S. Really, we need to be thinking about multiple health behaviors at once to help people achieve a particular goal, in this case, to be healthier, right? Because you can't, it's quite unlikely that you're going to have optimized your own health by just thinking about your diet if you don't actually exercise at all, or if you get poor sleep, or if you're suffering from considerable stress. And so how can you actually, and this is something that apps in their single function use become truly effective for that single function, but then they actually trick us into thinking we should just focus on that single function and not think more broadly. But really, probably the key to sustaining any single health behavior might actually be engaging in behavior change across behaviors at once. Because you try to change a health behavior within the context of a former lifestyle that was actually built to facilitate the original behavior, the unhealthy one. Yeah. If you don't change other aspects of that context, then the newfound behavior that you're trying to achieve has to fight against that context for the rest of time, and that's unlikely to succeed. But if you change lots of behaviors at once, create a new context in which a particular behavior you're hoping can succeed will, now you have maybe more of a better platform for success. And so there's this idea out there of multiple behavior change, the idea that instead of just trying to focus on diet only or physical activity or sleep or what have you, instead you try to actually make perhaps even only subtle changes but across multiple behaviors at once. And it's possible, there's some data to suggest that might actually be more effective than trying to isolate a single behavior at once. That's a controversial idea, but it's one I'm intrigued to look more into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a very interesting kind of approach. And yeah, you know, it can be very individualized and it's kind of tailored to that specific person and their needs. So very interesting. Mm-hmm. Are there any other questions? I don't see any other questions from the attendees. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we kind of close up today's talk?
Well, I might mention, you know, some of the other things I'm thinking about along these lines, because now you got me thinking about it. I think this idea of thinking more holistically, it's a difficult one, especially for us who are, if we're professionals in the area and we try to be evidence-based, we then often think about being reductionist in our approach to behavior, because that's how science often operates. We try to reduce down to understand particular mechanisms and then go from there to figure out the most effective way forward. When it comes to behavior is really messy, and as I mentioned, I worry about this continued focus on isolating behaviors without thinking much about context. And we probably need to be thinking about ways to marry behaviors together so that they could possibly be synergistic, so that they create new context for people to engage in. And so multiple health behavior change might be really an interesting way forward, along with thinking about, especially in the case of diet, sort of the ethics and motivators that go in behind that. Because these days, I think there's something powerful about not only marrying behaviors together, but marrying motivations together, where with diet, people are thinking a lot, of course, about their individual health. With, you know, parents, they might be thinking about their family's health. But now we're also thinking about environmental health and issues of food systems and connection to community, say, through local food systems. There are lots of ways that we might actually create motivations that are synergistic and benefit each other and perhaps propel new behaviors in stronger ways than if we're just talking about, hey, let's lose some weight. So just some food for thought for the audience to be thinking about: how can we actually couple behaviors and motivators together to create a much more profound intervention, one that could be sustained given it's much more about sort of lifestyle-wide behavior change than it is about individual behaviors themselves?
Great. Well, thank you so much again for the wonderful presentation. And I'm sure if there are any other questions from anyone listening in, I'm sure they will be glad to reach out to you. Now, was your email on the first page? I don't know I'm sure we could send out your email information if they wanted to contact you. Any follow-up questions?
Please do. It's my first initial last name, so cwharton@asu.edu.
Okay, great. Well, thank you again so much, and I think I'll leave Rachel to kind of close out today's presentation.
Excellent. Thank you. Just a reminder, I will send an email on Wednesday of this week with a link to the recording that we made today, as well as the handout and the CEU certificate you earned for your attendance. Journal Club will be back next Monday, 12 noon Eastern time. We're topic for the paper, University Students Intend to Eat Better but Lack Coping Skills. And I'll also mention we still have a couple presenters that have not finalized dates for Journal Club this fall. So we may actually be adding one or two additional speakers to the schedule. So kind of keep an eye out for those announcements. If you've already said that you wanted to be registered for the whole semester, as soon as I get those added, I'll go ahead and register you. But just keep an eye open. We may have a few additional presentations added into the calendar. And when I close out the webinar, if you'll go ahead and give us some feedback on today's presentation. And like I said, we're definitely looking for your topic suggestions for the spring semester. Thank you.